Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Raha Kansara, a reporter for BBC Trending, which delves into the world of social media. Today, we're looking at Iran. A word of warning before we start, this episode includes some very distressing accounts of violence which Iranian women have endured at the hands of the authorities. For security reasons, we've kept some details vague. The testimony you're about to hear is voiced by an actor, and we've changed her name to protect her identity.
That day, I went out. I put my medication and my ID in my bag and left, despite the risk. I said to myself, I'll go out, even if they arrest me.
Last year, Alif was arrested after a photo she posted online was picked up by the Iranian authorities.
I didn't really care enough to hide who I am or where the photo was taken. I wanted to say, we exist.
Alif had taken off her headscarf, known as the hijab, unwrapped it from her neck, and walked the streets of Iran's capital, Tehran.
Why did I do that? Because I needed an outlet for all my pent-up emotions, to share them with people who thought like me.
In a country where the internet and social media is heavily regulated and surveilled, walking in public without a hijab, and then documenting it for social media, was seen as an act of defiance. But why now?
The morality police was always out on the streets, checking our outfits. If we didn't meet their expectations, we could expect anything from verbal warnings to violence. They would attack women on sidewalks, drag them into vans. We witnessed all of this. But killing someone took it too far.
On 16 September 2022, Mahsa Jina Amini, a Kurdish-Iranian woman, died in police custody. Eyewitnesses say she was picked up by the morality police and beaten in a van for not wearing the mandatory hijab properly. Protests ignited by her death immediately swept across the country. First in Tehran, outside the hospital where she died. Then at her funeral, in her hometown, Sakez.
It was the vivid image of women at Mahsa's grave taking off their headscarves and flaunting them in the air that made me as determined as I am now not to ever want to go back to how things were before. Their bravery was contagious.
And then, across the globe. The slogan, Jin Jiyan Azadi, meaning women, life, freedom in Kurdish, became the rallying cry against repression and for women's rights in Iran. 2 years on, a steady stream of civil disobedience, on social media and on the streets, persists. But it's being met with an even harsher clampdown on dissent, using state surveillance. The Women, Life, Freedom movement predates Mahsa Amini's death. The slogan, which can be traced back to the Kurdish freedom movement, was first used in the early 2000s. When Mahsa was killed, it took on a broader meaning, to encompass rights for all Iranian women. The Kurdish slogan was Persianized and became Zan Zindagi Azadi. I've been working on this story for the past 3 months alongside my Iranian colleague, Ghonche Habibi-Azad. She explains what this movement has come to symbolise.
Iran and Taliban-led Afghanistan are the only two countries in the world that impose mandatory hijab by law on women. Younger Iranians have been increasingly defying and opposing the strict religious laws enforced in the country since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. In this revolution, the Western Allied Shah was toppled in favor of the Islamic Republic. Shortly after the revolution, women have been mandated to cover their bodies and hair in public.
The Shah pulled the chador down by force. These people are putting it up by force.
For years, the authorities have strictly enforced mandatory hijab law, using morality police on Iranian streets. But there's been a massive change in attitude in recent years following the Woman Life Freedom protests in 2022. The movement was a general uprising against the Islamic Republic. Iranians use social media to oppose the establishment, which includes morality police, and to voice their anger towards police targeting and arresting women in public.
Putting this into context is important. In 2009 and 2019, Iran saw similar protests.
These two nationwide protests were triggered by different demands, but they were both anti-establishment. In 2009, the protests, dubbed as the Green Movement, were sparked by allegations of fraud in the presidential election that year. But in 2019, the protests were sparked by a sudden increase in fuel prices. The authorities cracked down on both protests. Media suppression, including internet shutdowns, were also deployed. For example, although legally banned, satellite TVs are widely used in Iran. And I remember during both protests when I was in Iran, watching BBC Persian or other channels that reported extensively during protests was almost impossible for people because of satellite jamming.
In total, Gonche and I have gathered the testimonies of five people from Iran who were arrested for their social media activity since the Women Life Freedom protests began. Court documents shared with us show Iranian authorities built cases using their social media posts to charge them for propaganda against the government. Speaking to people wasn't easy. Before we made contact, we spent weeks developing our plans with the BBC's high-risk and online security teams, setting up burner phones and weighing up the pros and cons of various comms plans. That's because Iranians have limited privacy. If the people we've spoken to are caught talking to the BBC, we wouldn't be able to protect them.
The surveillance system has really predated current, internet technologies in Iran. It has always been a very big part of the Islamic Republic. With the advent of the internet, with, the introduction of much more advanced technologies and digital life integrated everywhere, it has become much more pervasive.
Mahsa Alimardani is a researcher for human rights organization Article 19, specializing in digital rights and surveillance in Iran. Since 2009, the government has sought to block Western social media platforms like Instagram, WhatsApp, and Telegram because they cannot control them. However, many Iranians have bypassed the bans by using VPNs to disguise their locations and access these platforms. The Women Life Freedom protests mainly spread through and were documented on platforms officially banned in Iran.
The majority of these protesters belong to Gen Z. We know Gen Z are extremely online. Their digital footprints are very wide. And so relying on the content on their social media, their private messages, either when they're incarcerated through detaining their devices or through tracking the activities of protesters before they're detained, we saw a lot of this kind of surveillance and monitoring.
Mahsa Alimardani says within the first few months of the Women Life Freedom movement, upwards of 20,000 protesters were arrested. To some extent, homegrown apps also provided the authorities with the perfect surveillance playground. You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. Coming up, we hear more on Alif's arrest, why another protester had to flee the country, and how the Iranian government has tightened its digital control since the Women Life Freedom movement took off.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the documentary from the BBC World Service with me, Raha Kansara. The last time we heard from Alif, she tells us she'd been arrested for her social media posts. This is what happened immediately after.
They blindfolded and handcuffed me, put my head on the seat, and when we arrived at the location, they put me in a solitary cell overnight. The interrogation began the next day.
Solitary confinement lasted nearly 2 weeks, and as the days went by, her concept of time began to fade away. In one interrogation sitting, masked guards pulled up her past activities, photos from her phone gallery, social media posts, images which showed she'd been shot at by security forces with pellet guns, because it proved she had attended protests. They used all of it to try to force a confession out of her.
They were recording me. I was shaking from my core, out of anger and fear. One of them started asking me questions like, "You're working with the US and you're being paid by them, aren't you?" And I said, "No, my actions were a personal choice. And even if I stepped out now, I will not wear my headscarf." He said, "So you don't regret your actions?" And I said, "No." Then he threatened me and said, "Since you're so stubborn, I'll try to get you the maximum sentence."
I won't name every charge brought against Alif, as they could reveal her identity. But her convictions included appearing in public without a hijab and promotion and encouragement of corruption and fornication. Her sentencing also included time in prison, which was suspended, meaning she wouldn't serve time as long as she committed no further offences. Despite this, the words of the masked men rang in her ears.
"Since you're so stubborn, I'll try to get you the maximum sentence."
Her maximum sentence included more than 50 lashes.
A door partially opened and I could hear terrifying sounds of a woman screaming. We couldn't see her and I'm not sure why she was screaming, but this sound, it gave me goosebumps.
On the day of her punishment, Alif wore her scarf around her neck and headed to the office where a young man waited.
"Are you the one who's receiving the lashes?" he asked. I said, "Yes." He told me to put on my headscarf and follow him. When he saw that I was still not wearing my hijab, he said, "Didn't I tell you to put on your hijab?" I replied, "I'm not going to." He responded, "I'll beat you so badly you'll understand where you are."
This tug of war over the hijab continued at various junctures until the male guard instructed his female colleagues to handcuff her and force the hijab over her head before leading her to an empty warehouse.
They released my hands and the male officer told me to take off my coat and lay down on the bed. He was holding a black leather whip in one hand. That's when he started hitting me all over my body. It was very painful. But I didn't want to show weakness.
Roya Burmand helped us contact people in Iran. She's the executive director of the Abdulrahman Burmand Center for Human Rights. And she told me it's hard to quantify how many people have been arrested and summoned to court for their online activity, because lots of people go quiet once they've been picked up by the authorities.
If you look at the charges, propaganda against the state, what propaganda against the state? So you're cracking down on people because the truth makes you look bad. So instead of not doing something that makes them look bad, they try to silence those who are talking about what they do wrong.
Surveillance experts I've spoken to say over time, the Iranian government has advanced technologically to tighten their grip on control. Part of this grip has been building their own nationalized internet, kind of like an intranet. They incentivize it by making it cheaper to use than the World Wide Web. But Iranians are cautious, and it hasn't gained as much momentum, because accessing Iranian internet means handing over your data to the government. Amir Rashidi, Director of Internet Security and Digital Rights at the MIAN Group, goes as far as to say that the country's surveillance techniques mimic China's.
They can geolocate where is your mobile phone. They can see what mobile phone is connected to what kind of IP addresses. And then they figure out what's the identity of the people who are using that particular mobile phone.
It's an ecosystem of surveillance that helps the authorities crush dissent quickly and efficiently. His team have even documented how they've used phishing techniques to hack phones and access people's data, as well as more traditional methods like encouraging people to report dissidents to the authorities. One man we spoke to volunteered for Basij some years ago. Basij is a paramilitary voluntary group that works with one of Iran's security forces, known as the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, to uphold the law of the country. He no longer supports them.
Right now, there are three organizations in Iran that you can report people to. For Basij Intelligence, it's 114. It's easy. You call them and they take a report from you. The operator picks up the phone. Salam alaikum. Go ahead. Then you give them your report. And they may ask you a couple of questions too.
Amir and even Mahsa Ali Mardani, who you heard from earlier, are also concerned about an app called Nazar, which allows people to report women for not wearing the hijab.
Two group of people would have access to the app. One, police officers. Two, a group of volunteers who are already being vet by the government, so the government trusts them. So they can have this application on their mobile phone. So whenever they see a vehicle is passing and the passenger or the driver is a woman who are not wearing proper hijab, I mean, whatever definition that they have, they can report on it. Basically, they can put the license plate number, they can put the time, location, and a description.
Amir says he found it on the Iranian police's website and on a private group chat on the domestic government-owned messenger app, ATAR. What scares Amir is how the app may be used in the future. He's waded through the code and says it's been built in such a way that its possibilities to report other violations are endless. Of the five people we spoke to who were arrested on the basis of their social media posts, three received suspended sentences like Alif. No lashes, but fines and the threat of further, tougher retribution looming over them. But one woman fled the country. It was that or prison.
In all my court sessions, they had printed out all of my Instagram stories. There was a heavy case against me based on my social media.
Kosar is the only person we spoke to who could go on the record with her real identity.
Right now, people inside Iran are under horrific pressure and are being tortured. If something were to happen to an insignificant person like me outside Iran, I accept this risk.
Before Mahsa's death, she'd been arrested 8 times by the morality police.
I knew exactly what they had done to Mahsa. I've experienced their beatings. When they killed her, it was like they had killed a part of me, like they had killed my sister.
Not one to shy away from speaking out, Kosar joined the protests. But her attendance at one march had life-changing consequences.
He shot me with a smirk on his face. I heard the sound of my eye popping. People surrounded me and began taking videos of my bloodshot eye. I had gone blind.
It's a horrifying story, but not an outlier. Social media, especially Instagram, is full of men and women sharing photos of the injuries they say they sustained after being shot at with pellet guns by the Iranian government. On Instagram, Kosar uploaded a video of the moment after she lost her eye. Blood is running down her face. Her gasps and her lack of words as her mouth drops communicates her shock and distress.
It's very upsetting for me. I feel a lot of sorrow, but I also cherish this eye injury. My eye is one of thousands that have been blinded by the Islamic Republic. It's a living document of this crime against humanity for me.
Her injury now served a wider purpose and drove her to be even more vocal.
I posted those who were killed, about others who were injured in the eye. I found them on social media. We talked to each other, and through our Instagram pages, we became the voice of others that had experienced what we had.
But the pressure from the authorities was mounting. She was followed from the theatre where she worked. She received threatening calls from private numbers, and she was slapped with two court summons in 2023. The last resulted in over 4 years in prison. Some of her charges included propaganda against the Islamic Republic, insulting sacred beliefs, disturbing public opinion, and blasphemy. Now in Germany, this year Kosar was able to tell her story to the UN's fact-finding mission without disguising her identity, an action surely denied had she remained in Iran. We contacted the Iranian government and put forward to them all the allegations contributors and experts made in this episode, but they did not get back to us. However, the commander of Iran's riot police has denied his forces intentionally shot protesters in the face. From my conversations with experts, activists, and Iranian citizens, one thing is clear. Anti-government protesters will not back down. And the morality police will continue to expand surveillance to enforce law and order. Though mass demonstrations have come to a halt, people are protesting in more subtle ways. Last month, Zahra Ismaili was jailed after she posted a video online of her singing Back to Black by Amy Winehouse without wearing the hijab. It's why these activists say a community of resistance leads the movement. A movement that's led by women and driven by a right to life and freedom.
We now speak often in our family and friendship circles about the Women Life Freedom Movement and our experience of it. It's like seeds of a flower. Even if a flower withers or dries out, its seeds go on and flower elsewhere.
That's it for this edition of the documentary from the BBC World Service with me, Raha Kansara. There are many thanks to give to producers Gonshe Habibi Azad and Cheyenne Tardarizadeh, Annie Gardner for mixing this episode, BBC Trending's editor Flora Carmichael, and to the Iranian women and men who spoke to us despite the risks. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a rating or a review wherever you get your podcast from. We'll be back with another episode next week.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.